Hello and welcome to this week's dialect. We're coming to you from Bristol City Centre, and we're part of the Bristol Radio Co-op. Hello to all our listeners in Bristol, our listeners on Preston FM on 103.2, and also to our listeners in Swindon, and also on Radio Verulam in St Albans. This week we have features from Anthea Page, Tony Gosling and Jeff Sparks. Our engineer Michael Noyce is back again and brings us another sofa session. This week he talks to We Are Yes. Malcolm Grieve reads us the first half of chapter 29 of Treasure Island, and we also have some poetry by Charles Thompson. Jeff Sparks is here as usual with his What's On Guide and Song of the Week. I'm John Peters Coleman, presenter of this week's show. Some small towns in Britain still retain their cultural roots, and Nailsworth in Gloucestershire is no exception. Our reporter Anthea Page met the town crier in the centre of the town, walking ahead of Santa Claus, not in a sleigh pulled by reindeer, but on the back seat of a cheeky red sports car. So let's hear more about that.
Oi! Oi! We welcome Father Christmas to Nailsworth!
I'm in Nailsworth and I'm just joining the town crier in his regalia.
Hello.
Where do you originate from?
I come from Frenchay.
And, so Bristolian?
I'm a Bristolian, yes. My wife is Bristolian from Staple Ale. We were married at Frenchay Church nearly 52 years ago. And then we lived at Fishbonds and also at Downing till we moved here about 40 years ago.
Oi! Oi! We welcome Father Christmas to Nailsworth!
Father Christmas is arriving today and will be in his grotto at the garden centre, all in aid of Horsfall House, the home for the elderly in Mitchinhampton. Oh, we're having a lovely day here, it's fine. We should be also here again next Friday for the Christingle evening. He is arriving in a vintage Aston Martin car.
Just stop and tell listeners what you're wearing.
I am wearing a red coat. The coat is made by the local firms in the valleys, and it is for Her Majesty's Guards Regiments and the black. So my cloth is actually designed in George III period, because George III actually visited Nailsworth, saw the red cloth, and it is since then that the red cloth of the Royal Regiments have worn the local cloth from here.
I like your little cravat in lace.
It's actually called a jabot, and my wife makes them for me.
Your shoes, they must have been difficult to buy.
You buy the shoes, and then they're very ancient buckles, or antique.
Where did you get your hat from?
The tricorns are made by a firm in Herefordshire. I've got several of them, and several uniforms. I wear red, green, what you see on the snooker tables. That's made also locally at Cam Mills by Dursley. And my other costume is blue, which is made from the blue cloth of the pool tables.
Are you the official town crier for Nailsworth?
Yes, and I have been for 20 years.
It's stopping the traffic now.
Today we welcome Father Christmas to Nailsworth. He will be at the garden centre from 12 noon today and every Saturday and Sunday until Christmas.
You've got a very powerful voice. Were you a singer once?
No.
How have you managed to project your voice so well?
Been married 51 years. I've got to get me word in edgeways.
Hello. What's your name?
Frieda.
What do you think about Father Christmas arriving in a big red shiny car?
Very good.
Have you made your Christmas wish yet?
No.
Hello. Father Christmas has arrived in Nailsworth. Do you believe in Father Christmas?
Well, for the children, yes.
But you don't anymore?
No, we don't.
Oh. So this little girl's going to meet Father Christmas.
How old are you?
5 3/4.
Oh, but that 3/4 is very important, isn't it? And is that your sister, is it? Or your brother? Oh, yes, I can see now. Yes. Hello, and what's his name?
Finley.
Finley, I see. And how old is Finley?
2.
2, I see. And now tell me something, Danny. Did you enjoy the presents I brought you last year?
Fabulous.
Oh, wonderful, wonderful. Yes, yes, we're getting all ready, aren't we? Yes.
Can we ask you what you've wished for Christmas?
I've wished for some zoo balls and 3D delights.
Let me see.
Oh, Father Christmas is getting his book out now.
Oh, now then. Now then, let me see. Oh, yes, yes, yes. Oh, we have, you know, Michael, no, Michelle, yes, no. Oh, but I think so. Yes, yes, I think so. All in my book. Yes, yes, yes. And you are all ready for Christmas? But of course you're not. You've got many parties to go to, haven't you?
After Christmas, it's going to be my birthday and I'm going to be 6.
Oh, wonderful, wonderful. Yes, yes, and are you looking forward to any snow? You are.
Hello. What's your name?
Vaughan.
Are you looking forward to meeting Father Christmas?
Yes.
Have you got a wish?
Yes.
Are we allowed to know what it is?
Yes.
What is it?
I wish I had the star book that had a magic, that had a picture of a star that turns on as a light and glows in the dark to see. I wish that.
Oi! Oi! We welcome Father Christmas to Nellsworth!
Town crying goes back to the times of the ancient Greeks. Came through the Roman period. It's one of the oldest professions in the world, town crying. It became to its peak with William the Conqueror. He brought 2 town criers and landed on Pevensey Beach, and they proclaimed him the rightful king. That was when it was originally thought it came to England. But then when you look at some of the old pictures and you see the burial of some of the old kings, you will see men with bells there proclaiming things. So it goes back. William the Conqueror made it a law, an act of Winchester being the capital of England, that all communities should have a town crier. He was the king's messenger, and therefore anyone that attacked him, it was treasonable offence. And therefore, towns in England can go back to 1068 when they had town criers. Nellsworth and Mitchinhampton had 1 town crier before Nellsworth became a town in its own right. And I've been town crier here for 20 years.
Is there a guild of town criers?
There's a guild of town criers throughout the world. There's about 250 town criers in England. The biggest guild and the oldest in the world is the Ancient Honourable Guild of Town Criers. And I was its chairman for 9 years till September 2010. And they made me the life vice president of the guild for my services to it.
How difficult is it to recruit young people into being town criers?
Most town criers go on as long as they can. I'm 73 and the oldest town crier we had was a town crier to Her Majesty the Queen Mother, Offie Hambert, who's now dead, but he was 93 when he died, Offie Howard. And we have town criers now of 86, still going, still crying. But the guild, our guild of town criers, is also a lower company as well. And I know from the Ancient and Honourable Guild that we have more members now than we would have last year. So there are more towns that are appointing town criers.
I'm now here with the driver of the car. Oh. Is it your car?
It is my car, yes.
Do you collect vintage cars?
Yeah, I do to an extent, yes. A limited extent. But this is appropriate for the occasion. It's nice and red. It seems to show off Father Christmas well.
Is this the sort of car that Noddy would have driven in?
Probably not. It being a pre-war Aston Martin, he probably wouldn't have done that.
So tell us more about your cars. What's the oldest car you have?
Well, the oldest is not that old. It's only a 1934 Riley. This one's 1938, so it's been going a few years now.
Is it difficult to find old cars now?
They didn't make many before the war, actually. Of this particular model, they only made 49. So that therefore there aren't that many around. You don't remember nowadays how few cars there were actually made before the war. Most of them were things like Austin 7s. They made them in reasonable quantities, but a lot of the other makes made very few cars indeed. Quite normal to have only tens or small numbers of hundreds of any car.
Well, I'm now face to face with Father Christmas. Hello.
Hello, my dear.
Did you come from Scotland or North Pole?
Oh, no, right from the North Pole. Yes, but of course, yes. And tell me something, my dear. Did you enjoy the presents I brought you last year?
I didn't get any.
Oh, but you must have got some. Just a small one. I always give you a small one.
I did get the little one. Oh, I'm getting my fingers tangled in his beard. So, come on, let's have the truth now. This is an honest interview. Did you fly from the North Pole or did you come by sleigh?
Oh, but by sleigh, my dear. But of course, Rudolph wouldn't have it any other way. But you see, we've got Dasher and Prancer and Cupid and... Yes, they all like to come by sleigh. Yes, it's nice to fly over the Cotswolds and especially Stroud, yes. And, of course, we have come to the garden centre in Nailsworth. And it's a very nice garden centre. I've been coming there... for quite a number of years now, yes, and I arrive in all sorts of different vehicles, you see.
Yeah, so have the reindeer got a day off today then, because you're travelling by car?
Yes, you see. Well, I always arrange a holiday for the reindeer at Barclay Deer Park. You see, they go and see their cousins, and they're very happy to do so, you see. And then I'm awarded all different manner of transport. And this is an Austin Healey. And it's red like me.
Just to finish off, shall I whisper you what I'd like for Christmas?
Oh, but of course you may. Yes, and what would you like? Oh, well, I think we can manage that, my dear. I think we can. Do have a wonderful Christmas. I know you will. I know you will.
Thank you to Anthea Page, who's talking to the town crier of Nailsworth in Gloucestershire, and also to Santa Claus, who happened to be in town at the same time. Our Jeff Sparks went to meet a pagan called Mark. He goes to pagan meetings every Tuesday. Their meetings are called moots, and here he begins by explaining what's coming up at their latest moot before our Jeff delves deeper into where they go, what they do, what it means, and whether you can turn up and join in.
This Tuesday, second Tuesday of the month, we've got the Bookshare moot. We find that in general bookshops, you can't get a large range of books on paganism. So we invite people to bring in interesting books that are hard to get hold of. Sometimes books that people have read and thought that's rubbish, and some, you know, or bits and pieces. So we can share that kind of stuff. We also occasionally have talks. We get people in, or people from the moot give a talk. And we also organise picnics in the summer. And we occasionally do a Glastonbury trip and places like that.
So tell me, Mark, what sort of person comes to these moots, and can you explain a bit about the different paths of paganism?
Yes, we have all kinds of people come to the moots. We have druids, we have Wiccans, we have solitaries, we have all ranges. We have people who have just discovered paganism, we have people who've been doing it for decades. So it's open to everyone, of all persuasions and all paths. So although different paths have different kind of focuses, we all get on. We all understand each other.
Around this time of the year, festive period, how do pagans celebrate this time of the year?
Well, generally we celebrate it just like everyone else does. It's a bit of a time off from the general run of things. We celebrate the winter solstice, which is the point of the darkest time of the year. It's the longest night and the shortest day. And so it's a kind of a completion of a yearly cycle, and then a kind of still point, and then a rebirth as the sun is reborn.
So tell me, Mark, what does paganism mean to you?
To me personally, it's kind of an intense relationship with the natural world. I think a lot of people are pagan without being pagan. You know, they're environmentally aware, they do recycling, they go for walks in nature and they garden and all those kind of things. And I think that's what a lot of us here do. Every year you get a cyclical kind of time. and we're coming up to Christmas, and every year we go round in a circle, and we like to celebrate points on that circle, and I really like those kind of things. It kind of brings home the changes in the natural world. I mean, we've had some pretty weird weather today, and again we're coming up to Christmas, so, you know, winter solstice time.
So tell me, what are the other points of the circle?
We have 8 festivals throughout the year, and they're spaced roughly about 6 weeks apart, so we're never that far away from a point where we take time out from the mad rush around us just to spend a bit of time contemplating where we are in relationship to the natural world and how we're feeling and all the rest of it. So it's kind of a timely rhythm throughout the year that runs through our lives, basically.
Finally, Mark, how can people get involved in the moot and where it is, and do you have an online presence?
Yeah, we have a Facebook group, and we have a Yahoo forum, and we also have our own website, which is Bristol Open Circle Moot, which is all one word, and it's .org.uk. And see us, I'll see you all on Facebook. You just put Bristol Open Circle Moot in, you'll find us there. We run every Tuesday from the King William at 8:30.
Okay, thank you, Mark.
Thank you very much. Nice to meet you.
Thank you very much to our Just Box, so speaking to a pagan, Mark. A reminder that looking up Bristol Open Circle Moot, we'll find the group that you heard of there. And the King William pub is opposite the Old Vic Theatre in King Street. And if you go there on a Tuesday night, that is the place to go if you want to find out more about being a pagan. And now we go from pagans to pirates. This is the first half of chapter 29 of Treasure Island, written by Robert Louis Stevenson and read by Malcolm Grieve.
Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson. Part 6, Captain Silver. Chapter 29, The Black Spot Again. The council of the buccaneers had lasted some time when one of them re-entered the house and with a repetition of the same salute, which had in my eyes an ironical air, begged for a moment's loan of the torch. Silver briefly agreed, and this emissary retired again, leaving us together in the dark. "There's a breeze coming, Jim," said Silver, who had by this time adopted quite a friendly and familiar tone. I turned to the loophole nearest me and looked out. The embers of the great fire had so far burned themselves out and now glowed so low and duskily that I understood why these conspirators desired a torch. About halfway down the slope to the stockade, they were collected in a group. One held the light, another was on his knees in their midst, and I saw the blade of an open knife shine in his hand with varying colours in the moon and torchlight. The rest were all somewhat stooping as though watching the manoeuvres of this last. I could just make out that he had a book as well as a knife in his hand and was still wondering how anything so incongruous had come into their possession when the kneeling figure rose once more to his feet and the whole party began to move together towards the house. "Here they come," said I. And I returned to my former position, for it seemed beneath my dignity that they should find me watching them. "Well, let them come, lad, let them come," said Silver cheerily. "I've still a shot in my locker." The door opened, and the 5 men, standing huddled together just inside, pushed one of their number forward. In any other circumstances, it would have been comical to see his slow advance, hesitating as he set down each foot, but holding his closed right hand in front of him. "Step up, lad," cried Silver. "I won't eat you."
Hand it over, lubber. I know the rules, I do. I won't hurt a deputation. Thus encouraged, the buccaneer stepped forth more briskly, and having passed something to Silver from hand to hand, slipped yet more smartly back again to his companions. The sea cook looked at what had been given him, the black spot. I thought so, he observed. Where might you have got the paper? Why, hello. Look here now, this ain't lucky. You've gone and cut this out of a Bible. What fools cut a Bible? Ah, there, said Morgan. What did I say? No good'll come of that, I said. Well, you've about fixed it now among you, continued Silver. You'll all swing now, I reckon. What soft-headed lubber had a Bible? I was Dick, said one. Dick, was it? Then Dick can get to prayers, said Silver. He's seen his slice of luck as Dick, and you may lay to that.
But here the long man with the yellow eyes struck in.
Belay that talk, John Silver, he said. This crew has tipped you the black spot in full council, as in duty bound. Just you turn it over, as in duty bound, and see what's wrote there. Then you can talk.
Thank'ee, George,
replied the sea cook.
You always was brisk for business, and has the rules by heart, George.
As I'm pleased to see.
Well, what is it anyway?
Ah, deposed.
That's it, is it? Very pretty wrote, to be sure. Like print, I swear. Your hand are right, George? Why, you was getting quite a leading man in this here crew. You'll be captain next, I shouldn't wonder. Oh, just oblige me with that torch again, will you? This here pipe won't draw.
Come now, said George. You don't fool this crew no more. You're a funny man by your account, but you're over now, and you'll maybe step down off that barrel and help vote.
I thought you said you knowed the rules, returned Silver contemptuously.
Leastways, if you don't, I do.
And I wait here, and I'm still your cap'n, mind, till you outs with your grievances, and I reply. In the meantime, your black spot ain't worth a biscuit. After that, we'll see.
Oh, replied George, you don't be under no kind of apprehension.
We're all square, we are. First, you've made a hash of this cruise, and you'll be a bold man to say no to that. Second, you let the enemy out of this here trap for nothing. Why did they want out?
I don't know,
but it's pretty plain they wanted it. Third, you wouldn't let us go at them upon the march. Oh, we see through you, John Silver. You want to play booty. That's what's wrong with you. And then, fourth, there's this here boy.
Is that all?
Asked Silver quietly.
Enough too, retorted George. We'll all swing and sun dry for your bungling.
Well now, look here. I'll answer these 4 points.
One after another, I'll answer them. I made a hash of this cruise, did I? Well now, you all know what I wanted, and you all know if that had been done, we'd have been aboard the Hispaniola this night as ever was. Every man of us alive and fit and full of good plum duff and the treasure in the hold of her, by thunder. Well, who crossed me? Who forced my hand, as was the lawful cap'n? Who tipped me the black spot the day we landed and began this dance? Ah, it's a fine dance. I'm with you there. And looks mighty like a hornpipe in a rope's end at execution dock by London town, it does. But who done it? Why, it was Anderson and Hans. And you, George Merry, and you're the last above board of that same meddling crew. And you have the Davy Joneses' insolence to up and stand for cap'n over me. You, that sank the lot of us. By the powers, but this tops the stiffest yarn to nothing.
Thank you very much to Malcolm Grieve, straight out of Swindon, reading the first half of Chapter 29 of Treasure Island, written by Robert Louis Stevenson, and you can hear the second half of that next week. Most weeks, our engineer Michael Noyce invites a band or a musician round to his room, and they have a sit down on the sofa, and they have a bit of an old sofa session. Gives them a nice cup of tea, and they have a bit of a chat about their music and what they do. And this week, it's the band We Are Yes.
When you're listening to nothing but the best of oldies, you're listening to Magic 98.9.
Just been listening to a bit of Here We Go by We Are Yes. That is We Are Yes. So that is yes. I have them on my sofa now.
Hello.
Hi.
This is Kev, Sean and Ollie. So is this just a deliberately confusing band name?
I think a little bit. I think it was good to be a little bit different, a little bit quirky maybe.
I mean, some people think we're a Yes tribute band, but sadly we're not actually.
We have had that.
It draws people in, doesn't it? It makes people think, question it, and then have a second look to make sure what that actually means, which is part of the marketing mechanism, I guess.
And then they have a second look and don't like us on the work anyway. But
yeah, so obviously it's not obvious what sort of style of music you've got from the name. So can you, in keywords, try and give us an idea of what sort of music we've got here?
It's high octane. It's dancey. That's what we aim to do. We aim to get people moving. We want to bring people up and then take them back down and bring
them
back up again.
Down again. Yeah.
I think the main idea behind it was that we all liked dance bands like Orbital, Chemical Brothers and people like that, but they always lacked that kind of live element. You go and watch them, but there wasn't that much interaction. It'd be a lot of sitting there pressing go almost kind of thing. Yeah. There wasn't any kind of, they're bringing stuff in and they're trying to sort of mix it up. But I think the idea for us was to take what people like the Prodigy and bands like that who would play more live instruments with a dance type style to try and develop that and take it on to the next step.
Yeah.
I think the technology now is much easier to do that, whereas back in the day it wasn't quite so easy to play instruments with a digital.
You need an army of people.
Exactly, you'd have to sort of bring half of the BBC with you to do it. But yeah. I think now with a lot of programs like Ableton and stuff, you can do loops. I mean, we live loop all our stuff, so the drums.
Live drums, live bass, live vocals.
Sims, vocals, and then we'll loop that into and what then, we do.
Yeah,
live,
so it kind of enables us to have a few more
people.
So
it makes it more organic, so it makes it more spontaneous to a certain extent. I mean, we do have certain things which are looped, but generally it's a lot more live stuff, and I think that's the idea, wasn't it, to make it as live as possible.
We were in a guitar band before called The Exiles. Two of the guys in the band left, so we were kind of left holding the baby, as it were, looking at each other going, what to do? And we went down that route, and it's worked. We've been successful in the last year. Yeah.
So you were in a guitar band, and suddenly you had no guitars in it.
Yeah.
Basically, apart from the bass.
Yeah, we kept the bass, and a few bits of electric guitar.
Yeah, we've got guitars, and the harmonica we're trying to get in there. Yeah. So we try and bring aspects of live instrumentation into it, and like I said, we've got the drums and things like that still coming through live.
So when you're playing live, it's not just drums, bass and vocals playing over what would effectively be a backing track. You're not just clicking start.
No,
it's looping and
it's a lot more organic than that, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because, as we said, the whole concept originally was to make dance music that was more organic and was more actually live people playing, so you could play off the audience to a certain extent and to play off each other.
Keep it quite fluid and
just take it, the idea of all the passion you put into live music of a guitar band. You do get bands that try and do that. We always try to add more sort of dance side of it, if that makes sense. Because I think there's a lot of bands that try and do it, like, say, Primal Scream. I like Primal Scream, but I think we try to be more dancey than that, more like the Prodigy. Sort of
a little bit harder, maybe.
To make it more clubby, to actually make it danceable. So.
So how do you actually go about writing your tracks?
It's normally a group effort. We all try to chip in with different ideas and stuff. But
Kev will normally come up with a demo.
Just because these two are too lazy to do actually anything. So. But I mean, I'll come up with a riff, and then we have a practice room, we just practice and jam out that riff.
Yeah.
We'll have a few drinks and just go in and see what comes out.
A lot of them are formed from like sketchy dictaphone recordings and things like that of Kev in the middle of the night waking up and realising there's a melody in his head.
Yeah.
And try not to disturb the rest of his housemates.
The custom comes in different forms, isn't it? I mean, often sometimes you'll come up with bits or she'll come up with a drum riff and then we'll work off that. That's so I think with the type of music we work with, electronic music lends itself to have lots of different elements, so you could have like a melodic drum sound almost, whereas you might not get that with a band.
Yeah, you can go anywhere with it as well, can't you?
Yeah, I'm guessing that because of the fact that it's more dancey, you're not going to be playing in the normal places like the Reckless Engineer or the Thunderbolt. You're playing more clubby atmospheres.
Yeah, I think we suit a kind of late night atmosphere, people who want to dance, but not necessarily to a DJ. So you've got the live aspect of having the band there and everything, but we like to try and provide the kind of environment for people to just get on and dance.
Give a bit of visual stimulus as well, I think.
Yeah, so we've got interesting costumes built with EL wire to try and give that kind of psychedelic feel as well.
Yeah, we'd like to do more on the visual side of things and get projections and things like that, and make it a little bit more
the whole event,
visually stimulating, which obviously a lot of the harder dance acts do, like Chemical Brothers and things like that.
What's rather than just making it three blokes with some synths standing there and boring,
Exactly.
We don't tend to have too many vocals, which obviously then you have to compensate with doing other stuff to stimulate people, to give them that kind of something else to look at or to listen to.
But yeah, even the kind of the loops that we have set down, we can be quite fluid with the effects that we put on them and changing
responsive,
them up.
Places we tend to play now would be in London and Manchester and Bristol, like Thekla and all over, really.
So Mr. Wolf's is always a good one.
We played at a lot of festivals in the summer. We had an absolutely wicked time, didn't we?
I mean, we were all from Glastonbury originally, so that was, for me, that was the highlight, to play Glastonbury.
This year was awesome.
And the weather was all right for once, so it's always makes it quite good. So.
And we had a great venue that I think suited us down to a T as well.
Yeah.
It was a place called The Rabbit Hole at Glastonbury Festival.
And we played it at Glade as well, didn't we?
Yeah.
It has a psychedelic Alice in Wonderland theme. So the head guy called Hamish is just wandering around looking like a rabbit when he's not in the hot tub before the young ladies.
Lunatic, but a lovely bloke.
Okay, yeah. So if you've got some gigs coming up, if you've got a website or Facebook page or anything?
Yeah, we've got our Facebook page, and I think actually our website directs you to the Facebook page at the moment. So
okay, so let's look on Facebook. So that's WeOuiYarJayesYes.
That's the one.
So we're going to play out with a bit more of your track, Here We Go. Can you tell us anything more about that track?
Originally, I wanted to come up with something that had a bit of a Stevie Wonder funk to it, and it just morphed from there, basically. It wasn't quite Stevie Wonder-esque. but it's quite funky. It's our style, it's our take, which I think is good. I think the best song you have are when you take an influence and make it your own, and that's hopefully all we did with that. So
it goes to different places as well, which I quite like about it. Although it kind of loops around things quite a lot, there's different places that it goes to.
Hopefully it makes people feel good.
Exactly.
Okay, well, we are thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah.
Well, that was We Are Yes, as in the French for yes and the German for yes and the English for yes, in case you're wondering about the spelling, and you can look them up on Facebook. So thank you very much to We Are Yes and also to Michael Noyce. Charles Thompson is in the studio with us now to read us some of his poetry. Hello.
Oh, hi there. Thank you very much for inviting me here. My first poem today is going to be, and my last poem actually, I'm just going to do one. It's called To the Dentist. Ah, ah, ah. Nobody talks about their upcoming visit to the dentist. Nobody, but nobody says, so when is your visiting the dentist then? They'd talk about it if you're visiting a Marxist, a lobbyist, a linguist, an anarchist, an archivist, a meteorologist, a chartist, a propagandist, an equilibrist, but never the dentist. As one such said to me before giving me anaesthetic, people don't like us. When 'tis your visit to the dentist then? Oh, next Thursday at 10. And I'm going cheerful, not hunched up and tearful. Cheerful, not beerful, cheerful. It'll be a fun trip, yes. Not a place where nightmarish thoughts get a grip of you like a barnacle on a sunken boat. As while you wait, you wonder why that bloke who's just come out has got a white pipe clenched in his mouth. Ah, what's it leading to? What's it leading to? Will I leave like that, unable to speak for maybe a week? Mr. Thompson, could you come this way? And I say, oh, yes, of course. No, not. Oh, no, not that way. Why not another way? Hey, I'll come back another day, next Wednesday maybe. But the dentist, she's nice and jolly, like someone who gives you a lolly. And the hypodermic syringe, why, I didn't even see it. It was in and out before I could even say, for God's sake, just take the tooth out. Take it out with a brick. I don't mind. I know you're just being kind. Then the drilling and the filling and what was really nice, little bits of wise advice. Chew on your left side, brush twice a day. And then I was on my way, saying, thank you ever so much.
Thank you very much. You have a little leaflet in your hand. Is this perchance something to advertise?
Thank you very much for asking about this leaflet. It's a little play that I've written based on a short story by a French writer called Prosper Mérimée. He wrote in the 19th century, and he wrote this little story called The Blue Room, which is about a couple of lovers eloping. Now, of course, people don't elope these days. It's gone out of fashion. You don't have to elope, but in those days they did. This play is a suspense comedy. It's set in the 1940s, so it's been brought up to date a little bit, but not completely. It's a physical theatre piece. It's about an hour long. It's at the Rondo Theatre, Bath, on the 18th and 19th of January, and it should be good fun. So anyone in Bath, 18th and 19th of January, the Rondo Theatre, which is a very good little theatre. Lots of excellent companies go there and perform their pieces. Please go along and have a look. I can't really tell you more about the story because I'd be giving away.
Okay. What how much happening. Does it get in?
£7 for students, etc., concessions, and £9 otherwise.
Okay. Thank you very much. Recently, Jeff visited Lindisfarne, the Holy Island, while he was out helping the charity Convoy Aid Romania. Here he talks about the history of the castle, and also, while in the church, he reads out a framed letter of apology from the Norwegians in regard to the Viking raids that occurred in 753 AD, which was the beginning of the Viking period.
The date is 8th of May 2009. The time is 10 past 6 in the evening. And the charity we are currently staying with and helping, Convoy Aid Romania, they have kindly taken us to Lindisfarne. And we've just driven across the causeway, which I must admit was an experience because we were waiting for the tide to go out and waiting for sections of the road to become clear. And in the end, we decided to forget waiting any longer. And we all jumped back into the van and drove straight across the causeway, straight through parts of the road that were still slightly submerged. That was an experience, but we're across, we're in Lindisfarne, and I'm currently walking towards Lindisfarne Castle, and I must admit, what an imposing sight. I'm really enjoying this. It is a pleasure to be here on Lindisfarne. Lindisfarne Castle sits high on an outcrop of hard windstone rock. The castle, originally an Elizabethan fort, became an Edwardian holiday home designed by Sir Edwin Lutyens for Edward Hudson, owner of Country Life magazine. The small rooms are full of intimate decoration and herringbone patterned brick floors. This is according to the National Trust Information Board. And there is some facts about Lindisfarne Castle. And basically, it was built in the mid-16th century to defend the island from the Scots. It was used as a fort from 1559 to 1893. In 1715, Lancelot Errington seized the castle for one night on behalf of the Jacobites. And there's lime kilns on the headland, which were built in 1860 and in use until 1900. Now, Edward Hudson leased the castle from the Crown in 1902 and eventually bought the freehold to the castle in 1918. And between 1903 and 1912, Sir Edwin Lutyens, Hudson's favourite architect, transformed the castle into a romantic holiday home. And in 1911, Gertrude Jekyll's planting plans for the small walled garden were implemented. And in 1922, Hudson sold the castle to the London banker Oswald Falk. Then Falk sold the castle to Sir Edward de Stein and his sister Gladys in 1929. And the de Steins gave the castle to the National Trust in 1944, where the family remained as tenants until 1968. We've now walked round from Lindisfarne Castle, walked all the way round to the parish church of St. Mary the Virgin. And as I'm looking at it, that is on the right hand side, and on the left is Lindisfarne Priory. So I'm about to have a look around the churchyard of St. Mary the Virgin Parish Church and have a look around the ruins of Lindisfarne Priory. We're in St. Mary's Church at the moment, and I am looking at a letter in a frame. And it says, to the Holy Island Church of St. Mary's, grace to you and peace from God our Father and the Lord Jesus Christ. It is with a deep sense of humility we address you today on behalf of the Church of Norway in the year of our Lord, 1993, 1,200 years after the assault by the Vikings on the monastery of Lindisfarne in 1793. In Norwegian history, the sacking of Lindisfarne is considered to be the beginning of the Viking period. As we well know, towns and sanctuaries were ravaged all over Europe the following 2.5 centuries. In return, our forefathers met Christianity on their travels. Equally important, missionaries from the British Isles risked their lives by travelling to the Nordic countries to preach the gospel. After the death of King Olaf Haraldsson at the Battle of Stiklestad, on 29th of July 1030, and the subsequent canonization as a saint of Christendom, the raids of the Vikings ended. In the picture here above, from Nidaros Cathedral, St. Olaf is depicted with the lily of peace in his hand, while his foot represses the power of belligerence. A replica of the head of this Olaf sculpture is given today to the Holy Island Church of St. Mary's from the parish of Nidaros Cathedral. The Nidaros Cathedral, where St. Olaf is buried, was a major goal for pilgrims throughout the Middle Ages. The picture above shows pilgrims making their way towards St. Olaf. Pilgrimage is said to be the move towards a sanctuary with the openness to be changed in spirit and to search for new values. In the spirit of pilgrimage, we approach today our Christian origins in England. We commemorate the event of 793 and the sacrifices of the monks of Lindisfarne with contrite hearts. We honour the memory of St. Cuthbert, Prior and Bishop of Lindisfarne, and greet you in thanksgiving for the Christian heritage we were given to share. We are united in God through our Lord Jesus Christ. Together we stand today, facing the spiritual and ethical challenges of our time. May our common memories of the past help us in this last part of the second millennium to walk the paths of the Lord into the future. Presented in the setting of holy worship on 18th of July 1993, and it's signed by Finn of Vargo, Bishop of Nidaros, and Sven Oppergaard, Dean of Nidaros Cathedral. To sum up Lindisfarne, I know earlier I said it was a pleasure being there, but once you look round the castle, the priory, St. Mary's Church, and you spend a few hours on that island, soon realise it's not just a pleasure. It's a privilege. It's an honour to be there, to walk around an island that has been a place of pilgrimage for 1,300 years. It was an experience, and one, it would take a long time for me to forget that. And I look forward to going back to Lindisfarne sometime in the future. Thank you.
That was Jeff talking about his recent visit to Lindisfarne, the Holy Island. For more information on this place, you can check out lindisfarne.org.uk. And for more information on Convoy Aid Romania, you can find them on the web at convoyaidromania.com. So, it's Christmas, but what is Christmas? Most of us think of it as the day that Jesus was born in Bethlehem, supposedly 2011 years ago. So to discuss the accuracy of this claim, I'm joined by Dialect's Tony Gosling. Hello.
Hi, John.
Have you been doing much research into this topic?
Well, I've just been digging around on the internet to do with the questions over whether Jesus was actually born on the 25th of December. And it's pretty clear from the evidence that he wasn't. One of the most obvious ones is that the shepherds who came to see him were supposedly watching their flocks by night. Actually, the sheep at Christmas time, in other words, in December, certainly were not out in the fields or anywhere outside in the Holy Land at that time of year. Okay. They would only be out, like, you know, it's in a similar way to the way we deal with cattle here in Britain today. You won't see generally cattle out in the fields at this time of year. They're inside, they're being looked after because they make a real mess of the grass and also because they get cold.
What about the calendar, though? The calendars are all different now.
Well, that's true. There is a bit of a difference in the calendar, but actually, no, the year is still the same, John. It gets warm in the summer and it gets cold in the winter. So
yeah, but what we call December now wouldn't have necessarily existed 2011 years ago.
I don't know if it was actually have been called December in the Holy Land. Of course, probably wouldn't have been.
Well, no, but...
But yeah. What I'm saying is it wasn't the cold time of year when Jesus was born. Most of the evidence points towards it being early autumn time.
Okay.
And also, there's another important signifier, and that is the star that appeared. Now, enthusiastic astronomers have sort of turned the clock back, as it were, of the universe and worked out that actually there was a very, very bright comet around at the time, roughly when Jesus was born in the year zero,
yeah.
And that actually occurred in the early autumn time. So it does look as if the whole idea of Jesus actually being born in the winter at all is a bit of a construct.
Where's the idea of Christmas come from then? I mean, how come it's morphed into such a different date? I mean, why are we not celebrating?
Well, actually, it's because traditionally, even in pre-Christian times, there was a big festival at this time of year. And the reason there was a festival was because everybody was having a party, basically, to encourage the sun and encourage the days to get longer. Because what we're talking about in those days, the year was divided up into four. That is between the two solstices, the summer solstice, when the sun is at its highest point and the days are the longest, and the winter solstice, when the sun is at its lowest point in the sky and the days are shortest. So that was a very important time of the year in pre-Christian times, because it was all to do with, are the actual days going to continue to get shorter and shorter and shorter? People were very nervous, and that's why they had a big party at this time of year in order to encourage the sun to go up in the sky again and for the days to get longer. Yeah. So that was the winter solstice, and the opposite time of the year in the middle of the summer was the summer solstice. But there were the two equinoxes in between, which is the equinox means basically in between, which were the other two festivals. These were considered fire festivals. This is what they would have, big fires at these times of year. And so basically Christmas is really the pagan winter fire festival.
Okay, and how did the Christians wind up latching into that and describing,
well,
that it should be the mass
as
of
many
Christ
other
instead?
Things, as many other things, Christianity borrowed and took over from the pre-existing festivals. I mean, the thing is, anybody that comes along and says, oh, you can't have that party anymore, as you probably know, is thought of as a party pooper, and they don't do very well by coming along and saying,
support.
No, you can't have that party. Yeah. Like Cromwell in the English Civil War, for example, tried to stop theatres and parties and all that sort of thing. And it worked totally against him. So that's one of the reasons, I think, that the Christians decided, well, look, rather than abolish all these old festivals, let's try and play it to an advantage and give them Christian ideas, introduce Christian ideas into those original pre-existing festivals.
So is there any reference to a celebration of the birth of Christ previous to the sort of pagan dates that we recognise as Christmas?
No, not as far as I know. The one thing we do know, though, is that Easter really is correct, because that was at the time of the Passover. It's known that Jesus was crucified at the Passover time. Okay. One thing I would say to wrap up, though, is that there's some very good source material on this. One is a book called The Golden Bough by Fraser. That was written about 1900, which has got loads of stuff about this if you want to look into it further. And the other one is actually by a Bristolian himself. Pretty much anything written by the Reverend Montague Summers, who was a reverend in Clifton and a church in Bitton. He died, I think, just after the Second World War, but he was a real expert in all this stuff. And if you check out anything by Montague Summers, you'll find more on the subject.
Tony Gosling, thank you very much.
Thanks, John.
Time for a What's On Guide, so time to hand over to Jeff Sparks. Hello.
Hello, this is your What's On Guide from Dialect. Starting with Wednesday, 28th of December, Black Eyed Dog, who perform a mix of blues-based psychedelic prog rock, will be performing at the Victoria in Victoria Road, Swindon. Entry is free and doors open at 8 p.m. On Thursday, 29th of December, Metallica tribute group Fixer will be performing with support from Hope of the Hated, Elysium Waits, In Ruin and Go Out With a Bang at The Croft in Stokes Croft, Bristol. Tickets are £4 in advance and doors open at 8 p.m. On to Song of the Week, and I present Crankshaft. Back in the 1980s, this group was the backing band for ex-Hawkwind vocalist Robert Colvert, and they were also members in a group called Inner City Unit. This is Crankshaft's Christmas song, and it's titled Everybody's Little Song of Christmas. That was Crankshaft with Everybody's Little Song of Christmas, which you can download for free at www.crankshaft, that is spelt K-R-A-N-K-S-C-H-A-F-T, crankshaft.com. On Friday, 30th of December, Figment will be performing at Mr. Wolf's in St. Stephen Street, Bristol. Entry is £3 on the door and doors open at 8 p.m. On Saturday, 31st of December, the Almost Anarchy Tour New Year's Eve Special 2011 presents the Sex Pistols Experience, Ed Tudor Pole, and the Clash tribute group London Calling at the Fleece in St Thomas Street, Bristol. Tickets cost £10 in advance and doors open at 8 p.m. Also on 31st of December, Goldfish Don't Bounce will be performing at the Reckless Engineer in Templegate, Bristol. Tickets are £10 in advance and the gig should start around 9 p.m. That's all from me. Thanks for listening and have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
Ah, thank you most excellently, Mr. Jeff Sparks. That's all from Dialect this week. Features were by Anthony Page, Tony Gosling, Michael Noyce and Jeff Sparks. And the poetry was by Charles Thompson. Treasure Island was read by Malcolm Grieve, Chapter 29, Part 2, next week. And the What's On Guide and the Song of the Week choice was, of course, by Jeff Sparks. The engineer was Michael Noyce and the producer was Jeff Sparks. The presenter was myself, John Peters Coleman. So until next week, take care. Goodbye.
Daddy, he don't hear him. He's yelling at the Christmas tree. Santa's ball.